Why New Orleans Matters by Tom Piazza, Chapter 2. I first visited the Crescent City, named for the curve of the Mississippi River into which it's nestled, in 1987, for the annual New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, universally referred to as Jazz Fest. I'd been planning to make the trip for years, and had always put off the visit for one reason or another, usually having to do with not having any money. That January, coming off a long and painful breakup of relationship, I attended a party thrown to help everyone through the final grinding weeks of a long New York City winter. Someone mentioned to me that he was going to Jazz Fest, which always takes place on the last weekend in April and the first weekend in May. "Why don't you go?" he said. "Think of the spiritual renewal." I began to offer my usual excuses about dwindling funds and taxes coming due. My friend looked at me in the eye and said, "Go into debt." It was the best advice anyone had ever given me. As time went on, I learned that this is a very New Orleans attitude, for good and ill. When you go to New Orleans, as when you go to Paris, people fall over themselves recommending favorite restaurants, bars, neighborhoods, music clubs, lunch joints, record stores, bookshops, streets, activities. One friend of mine in particular, a New Orleans native transplanted to New York, gave me a list of places to go. The Napoleon House, make sure and drink a Pimm's Cup, the Camellia Grill, get either the pecan waffles or the chili cheese omelette, Central Grocery, Best Muffaletta, Tipitina's, the Maple Leaf Bar, Lafitte's Blacksmith Shop, the Port of Call, Sid Meier's, Brennings, the names of the places themselves and the streets where they were located, St. Louis, Decatur, Esplanade, Perdido, Frenchman sounded mysterious and poetic to my ears, which were used to the numbered grid of New York City. The guest house where I was staying, booked through some fly-by-night accommodations agency I had stumbled across, was in a beautiful area that I only later found out was supposed to be dangerous. The lovely shaded stretch of Prytania Street in the neighborhood, where streets are named for the muses. Euterpe, Melpomene, Terpsichore, and Polymnia, one block off of St. Charles Ave with the streetcar, and walking distance from Lee Circle. If the Adams family had owned a guest house, it would have looked something like Longpre Gardens, a narrow Victorian wooden frame house with peeling blue paint, sagging porch, rusted knee-high iron fence, scraggly weeds in the patch of yard between sidewalk and front door. When my host answered the door, he looked me up and down with a raised eyebrow and a muted arch smile, welcomed me in, and informed me that due to a scheduling overlap, my room was occupied by someone else. I'd be welcome to sleep on the one available cot, either in the kitchen or, a significant pause, in his room. Sitting there in the gloomy, high-ceilinged, musty entrance hall, I had an overwhelming impulse to get a cab back to the airport and return to New York City. This was going to be my spiritual renewal? Sleeping on a cot and fighting off the advances of this sweet-natured old queen? Nothing personal to him, but that wasn't my thing. And anyway, I had wanted a place of comfort and restoration, not a makeshift bed in a kitchen. I tried to process it. I'd wanted to come to New Orleans for a long, long time, since I was a kid, and now I was here. There were places I wanted to see, and I wouldn't be spending that much time at the guest house anyway. I'd been fighting my own life for months, wishing things were different from how they were, and I'd made a sacrifice to come to a place where I thought they would be the way I wanted them to be, and now it turned out to be different from what I had expected. I just wanted to be somewhere for a while where things were okay, just the way they were. And then, somehow, a switch clicked inside me. Some spirit of place must have entered me, and I thought, why not declare that, as of now, things are okay just as they are? While you're here, declare things okay as they are. Take what comes. I thanked my host for the choice and told him I would take the kitchen. I didn't know it consciously at that point, but I had stepped into one of the most important lessons that New Orleans offers. Go with what is. Use what happens. Years later, attending second-line parades as they moved through all the neighborhoods, I would see this principle embodied in dancers who incorporate all the small accidents of geography, light poles, fire hydrants, cars, into their ongoing improvised dance. It was, in fact, the spirit of Mardi Gras itself, when for one day everyone in the city decides to go with whatever happens. But I'm getting ahead of things. As soon as I adjusted to the reality, the private room miraculously became available the next day, I got out into the city. The first thing I did was rent a bicycle on Frenchman Street in the Faubourg Marigny, which is to the French Quarter what New York's East Village is to Greenwich Village proper. Proper, okay. New Orleans is a great city for bicycling. There are no hills to speak of, so it never becomes an athletic event. There is an extremely active street life and sidewalk life. People like to sit on their porches and talk, stop friends on street corners for a chat, unexpected parades. The streets themselves are small masterpieces of intrigue and grace, with names that invite you in, story, music, desire, and harmony, and each has its own distinct personality. And of course, there was the French Quarter to look forward to, with its Burgundy Street and Bourbon Street. I biked everywhere on that trip. I rode from the Marigny out broad Elysian fields all the way to Lake Pontchartrain, a long ride in itself, then along the lakeshore to Bucktown and back down, skirting City Park and burrowing through all the neighborhoods along Carrollton Ave, finally coming out by the Mississippi River levee at the foot of Carrollton, rolling down St. Charles Avenue in the afternoon shade. There was such variety in the neighborhoods, rich or poor, shaded or bare, but they also had something in common, a kind of frequency to which they were tuned, different as they may have been. Always there was some kind of sign of gratitude for the fact of being there, whether it was lovely landscaping under beautiful trees in the Garden District, or a couch placed on a porch in one of the poorest neighborhoods, with a scraggly potted palm next to it and a man seated there raising his drink in salute as I passed. There was a sense of welcome, a sense of appreciation of being alive. The only place where this wasn't immediately recognizable was in the one or two housing projects that I passed. Prefabricated, gloomy places with burned-out-looking windows that stared like dead eyes and doors open to dark hallways. But even there, I would learn, people found a way to make life livable. The first meal I ate in New Orleans was at an unpromising-looking corner place in a couple of blocks from the guest house. I approached it philosophically. I was hungry, it was close, and at least it wasn't a chain. When the fried trout arrived and I tasted it, I had trouble believing how good it was. It tasted both of the fish, which was fresh, and of some judiciously wielded seasoning that I couldn't identify, and the greens that came with it had small pieces of bacon, the flavor of which suffused the dish. This in a place that somewhere else might have served fare that was mediocre at best. I actually laughed out loud. The next morning I went back there for breakfast and had eggs and grits and smoked sausage and confirmed my previous night's estimate of the place. New Orleans, as everyone knows, takes its food seriously, and food is tied up with all the rhythms of life in the city. Aside from the Catholic penchant for fish on Fridays, there is also the tradition of eating red beans and rice on Monday. Monday was traditionally wash day. Fishermen did not work on Sundays, and in the days before refrigeration, beans and rice was a slow-cooking, fishless meal that could simmer while the laundry was being done. And various neighborhood mini-traditions, often associated with Friday and the end of the work week, such as a long-standing Kermit Ruffin's barbecue fest at Vaughn's Low Slung Corner joint down in the Bywater. Really cool. Or the long liquid lunch at Galatoire's. As in Paris, visitors tend to map out their visits around favorite restaurants and tend not to feel they have really arrived in town until they've had the baked ham po' boy at Mother's, or Paul's Fantasy at Ugleich's, or a muffaletta at Central Grocery, or the Napoleon House, to speak only of lunch stops. I would have added fried chicken at Willie Mae's Scotch House, but until very recently that was a stop known only to neighborhood folks and a select handful of others. Then Willie Mae, a diminutive 88-year-old lady with a hairnet who still cooks all the fried chicken herself, standing in suffocating heat in the kitchen of her little corner store restaurant with five or six tables in it, where her great-granddaughter waits tables, went to New York City in the spring of 2005 to receive an America's Classic Award from the James Beard Foundation, and Willie Mae's got added to the out-of-town hipster visitor list. 6 months later, during Hurricane Katrina, it flooded to the roof. There are the great restaurants that have made names for themselves known around the world. Antoine's and Brennan's, Bayonne and Commander's Palace, and Galatoire's, Emeralds, Bacco, Nola, Peristyle, and newer entries such as Cobalt and Herb Saint. Then there are restaurants that are more local to certain parts of the city and which have loyal clientele and still serve world-class food like Upper Lines or Brixton's, or Gautreaux's, Feelings, Pampy's, Irene's, Café Degas, Sidmar's, Brennan's, Mandich, Casamento's, Clancy's, or Crescent City Steakhouse out on Broad Avenue, where you can sit in one of the tiny wooden booths from the John Garfield days with a curtain that closes. That's cute. These places just mentioned are dotted throughout the city. Uptown, Bucktown, Bayou St. John, Mid-City, Bywater, Upper Ninth Ward, and of course there's Mosca's, which is not technically New Orleans proper, being 20 minutes drive across the river through the reaches of the West Bank, a tiny place struck by the side of the road out in the middle of nowhere. One of New Orleans' greatest places anyway, and everything's served family style. Oysters roasted in a pan with seasoned breadcrumbs, a chicken cacciatore, with a rosemary sauce that is so good that you can and will use a second loaf of their delicious bread just to scoop up the sauce from the pan. Okay. Sorry. But the real neighborhood places, tucked away usually in some unlikely corner of a residential street, animate that day-to-day grassroots culinary life of the city. There's nothing fancy or elaborate about these places, to say the least, but also nothing humdrum or mass-produced or even lackluster, as I found out on that first evening. It is a point of honor to make food that tastes good. I don't think a New Orleanian would even understand the concept of turning out blah food so you could just eat and run. You can go into the most unassuming place, say Domelisa's, a sandwich shop with hand-lettered sign in a very modest corner house a block from the river in a residential uptown neighborhood, and get a meal that you will remember for the rest of your days. Or at least for the rest of the day. These kinds of places each have their own personality. Dunbar's, with its great fried chicken, Liu's, where until recently they still feature a dish on the menu called Wop Salad, Gorse's Cuban Joint back behind Rock and Bowl, Manuel's Hot Tamales, right on Carrollton. Walk up and they'll give you as many as you want, wrapped in newspaper. Or Mandina's or Parasol's with the St. Charles Tavern or the Clover Grill. But don't start talking about all the snowball stands. Snowballs being shaved ice suffused with any one of 100 different flavored sugary syrup. Like Hansen's or Plum Street Snowballs half a block from my house, or Angelo Broccato's Great Italian Ice Cream Parlor in Mid-City. Or the institution of the crawfish boil, for which folks gather at a friend's house where an outdoor table is covered with newspaper, and hundreds of boiled crawfish are dumped out along with the potatoes and corn on the cob that have been boiled along with them, and everyone eats and drinks beer until the host passes out and everyone staggers home. Many of the restaurants just mentioned, which their partisans love with the kind of love often reserved for a dear friend, were flooded or otherwise damaged during Hurricane Katrina. Others may or may not have been. The picture, as I write this, is still incomplete. This is 2005, by the way. It seems possible that a place like Casamento's on Magazine Street, which is a secret temple with shiny tiled walls dedicated to oysters raw, fried, and stewed, might not survive, if only because the local shellfish industry may have been dealt a lethal blow by the spread of the toxic floodwaters. It will be quite a while before the impact of the flooding is accurately assessed. Mandina's and Liuza's and Procado's and Manuel's are located in a section of mid-city where the flooding was severe. Their businesses may not survive. To anyone who loves New Orleans, this is as heartbreaking as the shattering of the stained glass windows at Sainte-Chapelle would be to those who left Paris. These are not just isolated places where people dine and whose demise is regrettable, but which are essentially replaceable by something else, no more than the death of one of your siblings can be shrugged off. Each of these restaurants is, in all its idiosyncrasy, part of a larger fabric, a culture of food, but whose meaning extends beyond food, as may be said of almost all aspects of New Orleans culture. A family is a culture, a language is a culture, and the food of New Orleans is a language, and those who prepare it and love it are a family. Food in New Orleans is rarely a means to an end. It is an end in itself, and one in which the participants are emotionally invested. As with New Orleans music, it is part of a shared ritual in which life itself is appreciated and honored in all its specificity and variety, its there-ness. It is not the master and commander relationship to food of the wine taster, the distanced appraising relation of the food critic, although so much of it would stand up to the toughest appraisal. It is the passionate, grateful, sacramental relationship of a kind of non-sectarian communion. You are free to believe this or not, but those who have experienced it know it is true. If all of it sounds vaguely religious, I would say that it isn't that vague. New Orleans is the most religious place I have ever been, even though much of the population is profoundly profane, pagan, and steeped in the seven deadly sins and some others not even listed. Beyond the obvious and close connections between music and dance in New Orleans, there is a close relationship as well between music and food. Music begins to atrophy, wrote Ezra Pound in his ABC of Reading, when it departs too far from the dance. In New Orleans, music begins to atrophy when it departs too far from food. The titles of so many tunes are themselves a clue. Louis Armstrong's Strut and Whitson Barbecue, Professor Longhair's Crawfish Fiesta and Red Beans, Low Gravy by Jelly Morton and his Red Hot Peppers. Trumpeter Kermit Ruffins, as often as not, will set up his barbecue rig and cook up a mess of sausages and turkey necks outside a club where he's playing a gig. Rarely is the best New Orleans music found in a concert hall where the audience sits separated from the performance by a proscenium, listening politely and then applauding at the end of each selection. It happens, but it isn't New Orleans at its most identifiable. New Orleans music lovers, black, white, young, and old, are much more likely to be found in places where they can dance to the music they love, holler encouragement, sing along, and, if at all possible, eat and drink at the same time. If that can happen in a concert hall, fine, but it is much more likely to happen in a bar or a club, often with windows open onto the street, or even, perhaps even most often, on the street itself. In almost every New Orleans club, the life of the club spills out onto the street. It doesn't matter if it's barn-like Tipitina's under the oak trees and a block from the railroad tracks at Napoleon and Chupajulas, or Kemp's Lounge across from what is now called A.L. Davis Park, but which all residents, characteristically, call by its old name Shakespeare Park, or the Press Tin-lined Maple Leaf Bar up on Oak Street, where James Booker used to wring unbelievable sounds out of one of the worst pianos ever destroyed by the hands of man, or the old Glass House or Vaughn's, or long-gone and much-beloved Little Peoples in the Treme. You'll find folks outside listening to the sounds from inside, taking a break from all the heat and noise, having a few laughs, and talking with friends old and new. Mac Rebenack, better known as Dr. John, once told me that when a brass band plays at a small club back up in one of the neighborhoods, it's as if the audience, dancing, singing to their friends, and laughing, is part of the band. They're two parts of the same thing. The dancers interpret, or it might be better to say literally embody, the sounds of the band, answering the instruments. Since everyone's listening to different parts of the music, she to the trumpet melody, he to the bass drum, she to the trombone, the audience is a working model in three dimensions of the music, a synesthetic transformation of materials. And of course, the band is also watching the dancers, and getting ideas from the dancers' gestures. The relationship between band and audience is in that sense like the relationship between two lovers making love, where cause and effect becomes very hard to see, even impossible to call by its right name. One is literally getting down, as in particle physics, to some root stratum where one is freed from the lockstep of time itself, where time might even run backward or sideways, and something eternal and transcendent is accessed. This is, of course, the function of all ritual in one way or another. The short circuit time and its dumb, earthbound mortal sequence and restate the things that will last and constantly renew the world. Nowhere is this more visible than in the famous New Orleans tradition of jazz funerals. In its most boiled-down form, such funerals, usually held for community leaders or well-known musicians, or for members of the city's many social aid and pleasure clubs, with names like the Money Wasters and the Treme Sports and the Scene Boosters and the Zulu Social Aid and Pleasure Club, which pool their money for such occasions, consist of a long church service, usually itself containing music, a sermon or sermons, and spoken reminiscences, which is followed by a ritual that stretches back well over 100 years. After all is done inside the church, the pallbearers, dressed impeccably in suits, carry the remains of the departed outside and place them usually into a traditional horse-drawn carriage, with the driver sitting atop dressed in a somber tuxedo with a black top hat, The family may ride behind it in the sleekest of air-conditioned limousines, but the body itself goes into the carriage. Outside on the street will be a crowd, often numbering in the hundreds, of friends who couldn't get into the church, or who didn't want to have to sit still for 2 hours in the sweltering heat, or people who were only acquaintances of the deceased, or people who had only heard of the deceased, or people who didn't know him at all. Most jazz funerals seem to be for men, but knew there was going to be a funeral, or people who just happened to live on the block or nearby blocks and came to hear the band and participate, or who just happened to find themselves on the sidewalk on a Sunday morning in a ragged t-shirt and beat-up baseball cap with a bill turned towards the side, a little red-eyed and worse for wear, wearing a smile and ready to toast their unknown brother's departure to glory. Down on the corner, somebody is probably cooking up barbecued chicken in a converted oil drum on the back of a pickup truck, and others have beer and sweet wine on ice in portable coolers. The word that the body is coming out is usually precedes the body by several minutes, and the crowd seems to get denser, hotter. The sun beats down on everyone's heads, except those who brought umbrellas, used much more in New Orleans for sun than for rain. When the church's doors open and the pallbearers bring the body out, deacons or funeral officials will tell the crowd to clear back a little, which it will do with some effort, as the bodies are all pressed together, and the brass band, which has been waiting, will start playing a slow, wailing dirge. Slowly, the men carry this casket to the back of the waiting carriage, the same carriage that is, literally or figuratively, awaiting everybody on that street someday. As this casket is slid in, the trumpet will be playing the melody of a hymn, usually just a closer walk with thee. In the old days, the brass bands had a wider repertoire of hymns. You might have heard Flee as a Bird, or Old Rugged Cross, or any number of others. And the trombone will be answering, and the clarinets and the tuba, while the bass drum emits a slow, low thump, and the snare drum plays a stately, slow beat. This takes a while to do, and it would take an artist like Bruegel or Daumier to capture the simultaneous modes occurring on the street. The curious people pushing in, expressionless, to watch and catch a glimpse, thinking about their own death, maybe, or that of someone they knew, or maybe just thinking about the previous night's episode of American Idol. Across the street, folks from the neighborhood laughing and telling jokes out on the front steps of their houses that face right up on the sidewalk. Doors open to the dark interiors, next to little groupings of the music and culture lovers from other areas who come to pay homage to the tradition itself. Some watching and taking it all in, some catching up on gossip for the music business, or the academic folklore biz, while out of the church across the street pour the well-wishers, the family, the grief-struck, and doubtless those who never liked that dead motherfucker one little bit, but who needed to attend for one reason or another. When the back of the carriage is closed and secured, everyone takes up their positions and the procession commences, usually with the band leading the way in front of the carriage, and, if it's a big enough funeral, another band bringing up the rear, and the whole procession begins moving slowly through the crowded street, with the trumpets playing the melody of the dirge, trombones wailing their responses, the high clarinets playing counter-melodies or harmonies, the tubas anchoring everything with their low notes and the drums playing in time, the snare drum muffled. In the old days, the snare drummer would play with a folded handkerchief to muffle the sound of the sticks as they stuck the drum. Behind them are the official pallbearers and ushers, anyone else who wants to be part of the procession, walking slowly, often doing a little stop-time step in time to the snare drum's little catch rhythm. They were officially sorrowful expressions, and some of them are no doubt sorrowful inside as well. But in the most profound sense, it is a mask of grief that is being staged here, in which the fact of mortality is being given its due, and yet is also undercut by what is about to happen. In the real old times, they would continue this way all the way to the graveyard before the next stage of the funeral ritual took place. But even New Orleans isn't totally immune to the worldwide attention deficit, and today this part of the procession will last for a block or two at most before the band stops playing the dirge. In the old times, the snare drummer would, at this point, remove the handkerchief from the head of the snare drum. And the snare drum beats out a familiar sharp tattoo, the band launches into a jubilant, life-affirming stomp, and the entire crowd explodes into dance. The procession keeps rolling, followed now by some of the greatest dancing that you have ever seen. Some follow the parade, smiling and holding up their cans of beer, waving to friends or with their arms around their friends, some executing incredibly intricate steps by themselves as they move along, up onto the sidewalk, around cars, back onto the street, or in duet with someone else, trying to outdo each other, never for very long until they split up and find someone else. People are dancing on porches and steps as the parade passes. Members of the parade will climb up onto light poles and dumpsters and even the roofs of cars. Don't park along a funeral route if you can help it. Dancing to the music in celebration of the fact that, cold as it may sound, it isn't their time yet to be inside that carriage. They know it is coming, and that is a large part of why they dance. The parade will wind through the streets of the neighborhood, usually passing by beloved watering holes, known or unknown to the deceased, where all may partake of a little liquid sacrament, wish the departed a good journey to the land of the shades, and then continue rolling, sometimes for hours. So which is real, the grief or the celebration? Both, simultaneously, and that is why it is profound. You might sometimes see a mother dancing behind a casket containing the body of her own dead son, with tears of grief running down her face. Most funeral traditions in our society are there to remind us that we are dust, and to dust we shall return. In New Orleans, the funerals remind us that life is bigger than any individual life, and it will roll on, and for the short time that your individual life joins the big stream of life, cut some decent steps, for God's sake. No individual life lasts forever, and it is the responsibility of those left outside the walls of the boneyard to keep life going. This isn't escapism or denial of grief. It is acceptance of the facts of life, the map of a profound relationship to the grief that is a part of life, and it will tell you something about why the real New Orleans spirit is never silly, or never just silly in celebration, and never maudlin in grief. Under ordinary circumstances, the word irony might come to mind, but the detachment implied by that word doesn't quite seem to fit the situation. It is a way of containing the opposites that are part of life in a way that allows the individual and the community to function with style and grace, even wit, under the most adverse circumstances. It has nothing to do with the vulgar caricature of this spirit offered on Bourbon Street to the casual visitor, a version of the culture where the most obvious elements are exaggerated and the subtleties erased. New Orleans culture is of a piece. You can't really lose one part of it without losing the whole thing. The music is part of the parades, and the basis of the dancing that you see or do at the parades. The parades are part of the rhythms of the year and of life, the anniversaries, holidays, birthdays, and funerals. They wind through the streets of the neighborhoods where people live. They stop for refreshment in the tiny corner bars where people drink and pass the time. And at day's end, after all the parading, people settle down to familiar food like red beans and rice or crawfish or stuffed merlin, or shrimp creole or oysters with the music and the dancing and all the things that happen still ringing in them. And that is part of the whole package, too. It amounts to a kind of cultural synesthesia in which music is food and food is a kind of choreography, and dance is a way of dramatizing the fact that you are still alive for another year, another funeral, another Mardi Gras. This is true at all levels of the society, but the maintaining and restating of the fact is a matter of spiritual life and death, especially among the city's poorest African-American residents, among whom so many of New Orleans' most recognized and important cultural expressions arose in the first place. It's tempting to say that if you are talking about the spirit, you are talking about something that cannot die. But the spirit can be broken and killed. It can even die of neglect. In Judeo-Christian traditions, the spirit comes from an independent God who is beyond time, whose existence, if that is the word, precedes that of mankind and will outlast it. New Orleans is largely Catholic, so it pays lip service to this paradigm through its institutionally sanctioned religious rituals. But in practice, the real belief is probably closer to the African-based religious systems, in which the gods live only when incarnate in human action. A ritual space is established, and individuals in the rituals act as vehicles for divine spirits. They literally make the gods give life to the gods, because without the gods, their own lives are meaningless. And without incarnation, the gods are, at best, incomplete. It is a form of consummation. Catholicism, with its devotion not just to the Holy Trinity, but to the Virgin Mary and all the saints, who are seen as intercessors and even divinities in their own right, has often been conflated with these African-based religions. In Cuba, in Haiti, and other places where Spanish and French conquerors took over people with roots in Africa, including New Orleans. Each saint is seen as the patron saint of something, travel, the sick, fisherman, and has his or her own mythology and life narrative and special powers and interests. They're kept alive in memory and spirit by special devotion, by prayer and observance, often by sacrifice. In New Orleans, this attitude or inclination is hardly the exclusive property of those whose ancestral roots go back to Africa. The Irish paraders celebrate St. Patrick's Day by throwing cabbages to roadside celebrants. The city's old-line Italians celebrate St. Joseph's Day for a week beforehand by making it St. Joseph's altars, on which food of all description is piled high in homes and at churches. People come into view and comment on the altars and give donations to the church. At the end, the food is donated to charity. Black New Orleans celebrates St. Joseph, too, with Indians taking to the streets and roaming all over town on St. Joseph's night. New Orleanians, poor, rich, and in-between, white and black and in-between, take their cooking and eating seriously, just as they take their music seriously, and their dancing, and their masks and costumes, and their celebratory rituals, because it is not mere entertainment. It is all a part of a ritual in which the finiteness, the specificity and fragility and durability and richness and earthiness and sadness and laughter of life are all mixed together, honored, and given tangible form in sound, movement, and communal cuisine. It is a religious attitude. But it is not the stern Calvinist religion of judgment and renunciation of New England, nor does it have anything in common with some virulent new strains of fundamentalism, in which the fondest hope is that our God, whatever his name is, blessed be his name, will come and really kick some ass, and wipe away all the crud and leave only the elect. Nor does it have anything to do with the false and obscene pieties mouthed by those for whom Jesus is just another means to get power and votes in government contracts. Its fruits are given freely, in an expression and an imitation of the generosity of creation itself, and very often by the humblest people in the community. But it is appreciated by all who have ears to hear and eyes to see and tongues to taste and hearts to love. And once you love, you cannot turn your back. End of chapter 2.